If you enjoy our podcasts, why not subscribe to The Spectator too for more from your favourite podcast hosts and guests? You can get 3 months of The Spectator for just £3 right now if you go to spectator.co.uk/trial.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. This year, 2024, is an election year in America, a presidential election year. And so we will be doing two podcasts a week rather than our usual one, because we want to and because we know you can't get enough Americano in your life. I am delighted to be joined once again in the Spectator offices by Chris Caldwell, the Claremont Fellow and very distinguished author of a number of books, including, most recently, The Age of Entitlement, America Since the 1960s. Chris, we had some rather big news in American politics last night. It seems we're getting quite a lot of big news from America at the moment, with the announcement that Donald Trump's vice presidential nominee is J.D. Vance, the senator from Ohio. He was the bookies' favourite by the end. What did you make of it? Were you expecting it?
Well, I've been traveling. I'm in London now, so I'm not in a position to have informed opinions about what's going on in Milwaukee. Yeah. But certainly from what I know of J.D. Vance and what I've seen of him, it's a decision with a lot of logic behind it. So to that extent, it's not a surprising decision at all.
Mm.
However, it does break from a kind of a Republican tradition of using the vice presidential nomination to shore up what the president lacks.
Mm.
And so it seems to make the Republicans have assumed that if they can name a person from a different region or a different political tendency than the president, that they're going to harvest the votes from both of those tendencies.
Mm.
I think what they've done in practice is present the public with a ticket that is kind of incoherent. And I think the kind of the original sin of this type of vice presidential nominee was Reagan nominating George H.W. Bush after he defeated him in 1980. And and most Republican tickets have resembled that.
Because a lot of people around Trump or people involved in the campaign, donors and so on, we understand, were pushing for more of a sort of conventional election strategy pick.
Right.
Like a Nikki Haley, like a Marco Rubio, yes. Like a Glenn Youngkin and
yes,
so on.
Yes, right. The money was really behind Nikki Haley.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like, you, Mr. Trump, have won over the populist part of America, but we represent the moneyed part of America. So please give us a vice presidential nominee who represents, everything that your voters hate.
And so in a way, it was an expression of great confidence from the Trump campaign.
It was a totally, as that's where the break is, it's J.D. Vance is the next generation of Trumpies. Mm. And, it was hard to see that for a while because he's culturally somewhat different from Donald Trump.
But there could well be some strategic thinking from Donald Trump, and strategic thinking specifically about November, because J.D. Vance is the senator for Ohio. The Republicans probably would have won Ohio anyway, but more broadly, he would appeal to those swing states in the Rust Belt, Wisconsin, Michigan, perhaps Pennsylvania. Because he is a white working class boy from a very poor background, and he has this sort of beautiful story to tell about himself, which is that he managed to get into Harvard and then Yale Law School, and then served in the Marines and then went into business, financial technology, made a success of himself there. It's a great American story.
Yes, he's a really special person, and I've met him only by doing a profile of him during his 2022 Senate campaign. And he came to the, into public prominence as the author of this memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, which is, it was big seller even in England, I think. It's a kind of a special thing to be a hillbilly. To be a hillbilly in Ohio is really a class thing in the way that you understand it in England. In the United States, when people talk about class, they're usually talking about how much money you make. Being a hillbilly in Ohio is Vance's grandfather came from the hollows of Kentucky and came into Middletown, Ohio, and found work in a steel rolling plant. They made sheet steel at it. It was a factory called Armco. It's still there, but it doesn't employ many people. And at its height, it employed tens of thousands of people and turned that into a middle class area. And at that point, those hillbillies, some of them did pretty well. There are people in Vance's family who have done well, who've become fairly well off. And the family itself is quite, it's full of smart people. His family are sort of accomplished and impressive in their way, but they are hillbillies. They're from the middle of the country, from a city that is now just a real disaster area economically, that has very few businesses. And so they're kind of looked down on. That's why I say it sort of resembles something like the English class system, which we didn't really have that before. But Vance has a fantastic ear for that. And you're right. Ohio is no longer a swing state. Between 1964 and 2016, Ohio voted for the winner in the presidential race every time.
Yes.
It was the ultimate swing state. In 2020, it lurched very decisively to Trump, and now it's a Republican state. But you're right, Vance has got a feeling for this class of people that will help Trump in many other states.
Well, he's also a convert to Catholicism, and that's another interesting aspect to him, because this national conservative populism movement, whatever you want to call it, does seem to appeal, particularly among the intellectuals of that movement, to Catholics. Why do you think that might be?
I'm not sure. I'm sure it does appeal to some of them. My evidence on that would all be anecdotal. I think Trump has certainly appealed to Christians in a way, over very concrete things, like his willingness to appoint conservative justices to the Supreme Court who have overturned Roe v. Wade. That's something that is probably a plus among Catholic voters. On the other hand, he has a kind of a crude, sometimes impolite way of addressing the public, which is less popular among them. I'm not sure that Vance's route into Trumpian populism is through his Catholicism. Interesting though the Catholicism may be.
Well, do you think it might be through the Teamsters and the unions? Because I was reading last night that he's built quite effective relationships with the Teamsters in Ohio. And Biden, a big part of Biden's appeal actually has been his friendliness with the Teamsters, with the unions in those areas. And perhaps Vance could tackle that.
Yes. You know, there's always been American trade unionism has always been very linked to the Democratic Party. That began to shift during the Vietnam War, when trade unions were among the most stalwart Americans backing the war. Richard Nixon took advantage of this and grew close to the Teamsters. The Teamsters also were, among other unions, manufacturing unions, police unions tended to back Republicans from that point on. Reagan had good relationships with unions, but unions have been kind of fading, all right? Democrats have tried to build up the public service unions, particularly the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Democratic unions are generally in the government or in kind of government adjacent things, you know, school administrators and that sort of deal. Vance has got this connection to the people who feel left behind by outsourcing. That is the people who still build things, you know? And that's, when you look at Ohio, when you look at his state and you look at how gaga they've gone for Trump, Ohio is a little different than other places. When I talk to people all over the country who like Trump, you know, they basically look at Trump in the same way that Trump's opponents look at Trump. You know, yeah, he's got a lot of energy. You know, I wouldn't want my daughter to marry a guy like that or something like that. But, you know, you either, the difference between you like, whether you like Trump or not is not your judgment of his character. It's your judgment of, you know, of whether you think the United States is corrupt or not. Mm. That is the decisive issue. Trump is a referendum on that issue. If you think the United States is corrupt, you will vote for Donald Trump. If you don't, you won't. But the difference with Ohio is these people, that it is the state that was probably most wiped out during deindustrialization. There are car plants there. There are a couple of them that I visited, or the areas where I visited in my last article that made, you know, 20 million automobiles apiece. And the people there consider Ohio rightly as one of the great high points of, you know, Western industrial civilization. And now it's all gone. Mm-hmm. Those are Vance's people. All those people who are historically, you know, labor, American labor voters, American industrial labor voters are totally behind him.
You mentioned Nixon there. Vance is the youngest vice presidential nominee since Nixon, I think. Thinking about Nixon always makes me think about Trump, because Nixon had the most extraordinary Lazarus-like comeback in his career. If we think Donald Trump now looks increasingly likely to be the next president of the United States, I mean, this is one of the most extraordinary political comebacks, given January the 7th, 2021, and the mood about Donald Trump then.
Yes, I think it is. I mean, it just seems to be, there was such a, you know, a multi-front press by American elites against Trump, and they have managed to convict him on one of the cases they had against him, but that to his voters, apparently, that only serves as further confirmation of the country's corruption. So we do have a kind of tribal politics, and you know, it's worth, you know, bearing in mind that we are writing, we are talking on the, you know, just in the immediate aftermath of Trump's shooting, so at which I think is going to lead to a lot of sympathy for him, is going to make it sort of more difficult for the Democrats to have their argument about whether to replace Joe Biden. So Trump does look stronger in these days than he has, you know, in the past few weeks. I think whether he makes it in the election or not, you're right. This is an amazing political comeback. It's a political comeback not after years in the wilderness like Nixon spent in the 60s, but you know, maybe it's more like the political comeback that the Brexiters executed in 2019 and 2020, after it looked like Brexit had been derailed, you know, in the 3 years since the referendum.
Do you think since the shooting on Saturday, quite a few people have come out on social media, some big figures, major potential donors too, have come out saying that Donald Trump, expressing open support for Donald Trump, whereas they probably wouldn't have done not so long ago. Do you think that shooting could turn into a moment where people feel a lot more comfortable about expressing their support for Donald Trump, and people who just didn't like Donald Trump might like him? Because, well, for young people and for a few Americans, he is, to use a very modern American word, a badass.
Yeah.
Am I saying
that's
that right?
That's interesting. I don't know that people who did, he's such a polarizing figure. I'm not sure that people who didn't like him will begin to like him. But, you know, if you feel strongly, you know, about the perils of the injection of violence, I mean murderous violence. Remember, people were killed on you know, this weekend. Then it's sort of natural to rally to the victim of it. I think, and it's natural to look at, you know, the demonization of Donald Trump. You know, we don't know what caused this guy to do this exactly. We don't know what kind of news he was consuming, but it's natural to look at the demonization of Donald Trump in a more negative light. But finally, I think that the Democrats' talking points in recent weeks have tended to revolve around January 6th. Mm. And the idea that the Trump or people around him or his camp constitute some sort of non-democratic threat of, you know, upheaval or violence. And this episode sort of neutralizes that. It sort of shows that threat comes from both camps. And so I think it does give a lot of people a lot of food for thought.
Yes. And Democrats can't seem to stop themselves from using the very rhetoric that they pretend to denounce. I mean, for instance, J.D. Vance last night was immediately called by the Biden administration a far-right extremist. That's 24 hours after Joe Biden talked about calming down the rhetoric and so on. They do sound a bit ridiculous.
Well, that they feel that has been a... I think that Democrats feel that there are social mores in place, which they call structures of permission, which I think allow them to shame people out of voting for Republicans. It's not really a very classy thing to do to vote for Republicans. And it has been effective for them in the past. And it's really tough to break rhetorical habits, as you know, as anyone who observes politics will see.
Mm. Donald Trump is a very superstitious man, we're led to understand, and he seems to think that his very near brush with death is luck or God, as he put it. Do you think perhaps he might be thinking things are going too well, as superstitious men tend to do? Because there's quite a long way to go till November still. And things are looking extremely good for him. And there might be a danger of some hubris coming in the Republican movement at the moment about it.
I think there's hubris is an ever-present danger in politics. But yeah, if he's considering this in a superstitious way, I think it's only natural. I think everyone is sort of struck by the way this episode seemed to... I mean, everyone who remembers downloading these, you know, the video when it happened, and it's just so, there's something that's almost, there's something almost mythic or biblical about the story, the nearness of the miss, the infinitesimal measure that would have turned that incident into something very different and absolutely horrifying. You know, it was horrifying for the family of the man who died, but I mean, I'm talking about on a national symbolic level. And the blood and the gesture of Trump, an extraordinary instinct for, you know, what his followers were seeking from him when he said, you know, raised his fist and said, fight, and they responded immediately, you know. So it really is a very unsettling thing that's happening that's speaking to voters at some deep symbolic or anthropological level. I find it, I can't think of anything quite like it in my life.
Mm. And there's a lot of talk about Trump moving towards being a unifying figure now. He suggested he would in an interview with Byron York on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
That he's going to rip up his, or he has ripped up his speech, which was going to be very fighty and tough, and is going to be more harmonious, perhaps. Does that work for Donald Trump, presenting himself as a unifying figure?
It will be interesting to see. You know, I mean, I remember during the riots after the death of George Floyd in 2020, Trump tried to sort of like sell a piece of legislation or an action to the broader public by saying George Floyd is looking down on us and smiling or something like that. And it came off as a little bit kind of like that's not really his area of expertise. But under the circumstances in which everything is really sort of like white hot and, you know, all the rhetoric is white hot, if he wants to try to do it, I think it would be welcome.
Yes. And it would again appeal to people who don't normally like Donald Trump. Yeah.
Well, that is what remains to be seen. Just how dug in people are. I mean, we have the impression that there are only about 6 to 8% of the, you know, the voters in the country are persuadable.
Yes.
So we'll see if an incident like this may shock them into opening their minds or something.
And there was some chatter last night that RFK Jr. is considering endorsing Trump, which would be quite a significant thing, would it not?
Well, I mean, that's interesting. If it happened, yes, it would be. It would be interesting. It's tough to see what RFK's role in the campaign is going to be now. I'm not saying he has none, but you know, if we're correct that this is kind of neutralized, this incident has kind of neutralized some of the concerns about January 6th, you know, there might not be as much need for someone who can appeal to voters who want neither the instability of Trump and his followers, nor the senility, if we can call it that, of Biden and his followers.
Hmm. Going back to J.D. Vance, finally, Chris, you talked about, you know, how he could be almost a kind of better vehicle for Trumpism than Trump.
I'm not sure that's exactly the way I put it. But he's a younger generation person, and you know, Trump's virtues are those of brashness and uncouthness. They're not those of sort of like laying out things in a good explanatory way. J.D. Vance is a really smart guy. Mm. And there are a lot of people of his generation who are very accomplished and who might have the patience and the knowledge of how you run a political system to achieve things where Trump has not achieved things. So it's an open question how second generation Trumpism is going to work, you know,
without its king, because Trump's real appeal is that he can appeal to almost anybody because they get this sense of his charisma, his ability to sort of connect with people sorts of ways.
At the same time, he hasn't given evidence of really being able to manage government projects. And so what was missing, whether you like him or not, in his first term was a sort of a bureaucracy that could really begin acting with a sense of purpose to enact Trumpism. It sort of shocked everyone to discover, as Trump went out to the country to demand to ask for a second term, that none of this wall that he'd kept talking about for like 4 years had really been built, or barely any of it. And so,
and Trump in some ways was a bridge between kind of Bush era conservatism and where we seem to be going now, because he watched a lot of Fox News, he buys into low taxes, he understands business people. He had before they'd started to hate him, most of the business community liked him and admired him.
Yes, and he passed that bill, which was a supply side, a Reagan era supply sider's dream. The Trump
which tax cut of 2017 wouldn't
Trump,
do.
Which J.D. Vance doesn't like. So that tax cut came from a sort of a group that was close to the supply siders, to Grover Norquist and other Washington figures who were big for cutting every tax possible on businessmen, and it was backed by the Club for Growth, which is a low tax lobby, which backed Vance's opponent in the Ohio primary. At which point, Vance took to calling them the Club for Chinese Growth. So that's the strong element in Vance. He does have he's very interested in protecting this class of people from which he comes, and he thinks that the kind of wide open world trade and the tax cuts for the rich does not fall under that task.
Christopher Caldwell, thank you very much for coming on to the Americano Show. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
Likewise, Freddie.
That's all for this episode of the Americano podcast. I'd like to thank my brilliant producer, Natasha Farrows, and urge you to leave a generous, kind, and warm-hearted review of this podcast on whichever platform you listen to it.